In the 1500s, there was a mathematician named Michael Stifel. He was a supporter of Martin Luther, which was a good thing. And he liked to calculate the ending of all things, which was a bad thing. Being a mathematician, he was prone to examining numbers and prophecies in the Bible. And well, his prediction is that the world would end on October 19th, 1533, at 8 a.m. It's very specific with the time, 8 a.m. And there was once a Baptist preacher in the 1800s named William Miller, who prophesied that Jesus would return on October the 22nd, 1844. Later in the 1800s, a man arose named Charles Taze Russell, who founded the cult known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. And Charles Russell predicted Christ would return in 1874. Later that century, Joseph Smith became influential, founding the Cult of Mormonism, and predicted Christ would return in 1891. Let's move to the 1900s. Many other examples from the 1800s. Former NASA engineer Edgar Weissenot wrote a book entitled 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. When 1988 came and went, would you believe he had a revised edition along the way with 89 reasons why, and you can figure out the rest, 1989. You might remember in the 2000s, a man named Harold Camping, who predicted Christ would come and the world would end May 21st, 2011. On May the 22nd, realizing the error of his calculations, he said it was actually going to be this fall. October 21st, 2011 was his new prediction. For centuries, this kind of thing has gone on. And it's not going to stop, unfortunately. More people will make predictions which do not come true, creating hysteria, stirring a lot of anticipation and hope, and harming credibility by saying they speak for Christ, His church, and sound doctrine. We should hear the words of Christ over against such false predictors. And the words of Christ this morning in Mark 13 are about His return. Starting in verses 32 to 37, we're going to see a new topic, a shift from what the last few weeks have been focusing on. This month so far, I've been arguing that Mark 13 was given to His disciples on the Mount of Olives because of an upcoming horrible time of tribulation and judgment in Jerusalem and against the temple in particular that their generation would see. Sure enough, before the generation passed away, as Jesus said, the army of Rome destroyed the city and the temple. Coming against the city and the temple, but mainly destroying the temple. The near horizon event was the focus of the verses to this point, but now we're going to see a shift. When we were going through the Gospel of Matthew a few years ago, we come to Matthew's account at this point in Passion Week as well. And at that time, a few years ago, I argued then what I'm going to argue today, that when Jesus begins to speak about a day and an hour, He's going to be talking about something different from the previous near horizon judgment. Now, there are a few reasons for this. I want us to think carefully about what's different about this passage we just heard read a moment ago. First of all, the opening words, but concerning. It might not stand out as much to us in the English text, but in the original language, this is a particular phrase cueing a new topic in many uses in the New Testament, especially in some of the letters of Paul. And so when you see Jesus talking about one particular thing and then getting to a place where He says, but concerning this, it is very likely that the grammar indicates a shift. Consider, secondly, the use of the singular day and singular hour. Prior to this, He's been talking about these things, plural, these days and those days. But He wants to focus on a day and an hour. Thirdly, right before Jesus' words, look at what capped off our passage from last week. He says in verse 30, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." It's a very climactic set of verses right there where he seems to take everything he said and then says, not until this generation, these things will happen before this generation passes away. All heaven and earth will pass away before my words would. That feels like a marker in the text to shift something. So that if something's going to happen before the generation of the disciples pass away, and he just referred to that, what he's going to talk about now is beyond the generation of the disciples. So everything to this point, before that generation passes away. But now he has said that. He has covered these things unfolded. Something new is coming now. Something beyond the generation of his disciples. And then fourthly, these verses address an unexpected event. And by that I mean it's a surprise when it happens. No one's seeing it coming. Like they can see someone coming down the road and with their hand to their brow, they say, okay, I can tell, and so I can warn everybody inside, this is just along the way. That's very different from the previous verses. Jesus has talked about the disaster upon Jerusalem preceded by false prophets, political upheaval, natural disasters, persecution of the saints, all of which the disciples experienced. But he doesn't give them any signs to look for, any indicators in these verses, in verses 32 to 37. Rather, it's as if while previously you could tell something was on the horizon for you, for the city, for the temple, that is not the case with what he's going to talk about now. There's no kind of timing attached to what Jesus begins addressing. In fact, while earlier he said this generation won't pass away before these things take place, about this particular day and hour, he said, no one knows. No one knows. The day and hour is the day of final judgment. The Old Testament background fills in the gaps here. The people of God in the Old Testament longed for the day when his righteousness and justice would fill the earth and his holiness would be praised and exalted. The day of the Lord would be when the wicked would face the righteousness of God and the people of God would be vindicated through resurrection and eternal life. And Jesus says, that day, that hour, concerning that day and hour, I want to speak now. But no one knows when, he says. Now, he could have just said, no one knows when, and we might have thought to ourselves, yeah, no one, except probably you, Jesus. And then he just moves on to something else. He, though, begins to get specific about who doesn't know. He says, not even the angels know, the angels in heaven. This means the angels, these glorious beings who dwell in the presence of God, do not know when the final day of judgment for mankind will come. The angels serve the purposes of God, but in so doing, they do not know the mind of God. They are not God. Jesus then says, nor the Son, but only the Father, making a distinction between the Father and the Son, and saying something the Son does not know. Verse 32. This is one of these verses that when a Christian comes across it in the Bible, we naturally and understandably say, what am I supposed to do with this verse? This is odd. I didn't expect him to go here. Now, why do we feel that instinctive response seeing the claim of Christ here? Well, I think for a couple reasons. Number one, because we are eager to affirm the deity of the Son of God. It's because of who we believe Scripture teaches Christ to be, that he is namely divine, that we say, then how do we make sense of this? Because secondly, we know what divine entails. Being divine would entail perfect knowledge, and not just in one direction, but to know everything that has happened, is happening, and will happen. That this is truly what it means for God to be omniscient, to be all-knowing. There's nothing God does not know. The mind of God is fully aware of everything in the world. Therefore, when we come to a verse like this, how can the Son say that he does not know something? All right, here's the way I think we should read this claim. We should see his claim that the Son does not know, but only the Father, as in the same category of other truths about Jesus in his humanity. All right, so let's follow a certain line of reasoning here by borrowing events from the other Gospels. In his humanity, Jesus became truly hungry. He became truly thirsty. He became truly tired. I mean, when Jesus is going to bed at night, we shouldn't imagine him laying in bed thinking, I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm God. I don't need sleep. You know, 8 more hours have to pass, or however long he would sleep. Rather, comes to the end of a long day, and he needs to go to sleep because he's really tired. Because he's truly human. In Luke 2:52, we're told Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature regarding his humanity. In Luke 2:52, the narrator says that. These are all things we can affirm as part of his genuine humanity. Jesus was not pretending to be human. He did not just appear to be a man. He was truly man with a human mind and a human will. Who will in short order say to the Father in Mark 14, not my will, but your will be done. His humanity in his weakness and frailty on display again and again. He was born. He needed to grow. His brain had to develop. When I was younger, I used to wonder if when Jesus was a baby, he had perfect, clear thoughts about all things and thought to himself, this is going to take a long time. I got decades and I'm a baby, you know. I don't think that's the way to think about it at all, actually. I think he had to learn to speak, learn to walk, learn to write. Truly human. We must not be so eager to affirm his deity that we deny to him a genuine humanity. That's not helpful. It creates an imbalance that fails to make sense of a whole host of gospel passages. We must not be so eager to affirm his deity that we deny to him a genuine humanity. I think we can understand certain actions of Christ in his ministry as according to a divine nature or according to his human nature in different episodes, such as, and you could come up with some of these on your own, when Jesus walks on the water, when he forgives sins, when he claims, before Abraham was, I am, when he stills the storm. He's doing these things according to his divine nature. This is not something a mere man does. But when he is thirsty, when he is tempted, when he has to walk from one city to the next, when he sleeps because he is tired, all of these are part of a category of reasons showing his humanity is on display as well in the Gospels. This is the paradox of the Incarnation. And you see these things going on, and yet it is one person, the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, two natures on display in his ministry. Jesus knew, as a man, what the Father gave him. As an obedient son, he lived in submission to the Father, saying that he does what his Father gives him to do. And all that the Father gave him to say, he has said. And so as a man, what he knows is what he has been given to know. So when he says, the Son does not know, I think he's speaking about in the same way how we would see genuine tiredness or thirst. He's saying, it's not given to man to know the time of the judgment. It's not given to man. And I am one too. So in his claims, he is demonstrating and putting on display what elsewhere we see as his truly human nature. He lived in prayerful dependence on the Father in spirit. He walked in a manner that was pleasing and sinless and also fully human. Now, that is a paradox. The mystery of the Incarnation. That in John 1:14, the Word that was with God and was God became flesh, not negating his divine nature, but taking to himself a genuine human nature. Okay, so that's how I think we should think of verse 32. Considering it along the same lines as genuine humanity expressed and a whole host of other gospel passages. Now, he tells them this in order to call them to something. If they don't know when the return of Christ is, if they don't know the final judgment's day and hour, then they need to be watchful and on guard. So here's his call to them. What would be that appropriate response? It's this in verse 33. Be on guard. Keep awake. For you don't know when the time will come. These two commands go together. You're not going to be very effectively on guard if you're not awake. You set somebody on guard, watch over something, and you come and you find them sleeping. Well, then who knows, whatever they were guarding is still there or in the same condition in which you left it. He says you got to be on guard and keep awake. Why? For you don't know when the time will come. There's a watchfulness then, a preparedness that is appropriate. The disciples of Christ are to have that posture of living. When he's talking about being awake, he's speaking metaphorically here. He is not talking about actual sleep and actual being awake with your eyes open. He's talking about a kind of life, a posture of living that you might call wakeful living. Of course, we need to sleep. Jesus wouldn't deny that. He himself did. We simply recognize that here he's talking to them about being on guard and awake in light of something coming that they don't know the day or hour of. Now he's going to illustrate this with a little parable. It's not long. It's just one verse in verse 34. He wants them to think of a man. Here's what it's like. And a parable is a comparison. And that's what he's doing. He's making a comparison here. It's like a man who's going on a journey. And when he leaves home, he puts his servants in charge, each with his work. And he commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. All right, you imagine this guy goes into his bedroom, pulls out everything he needs from the drawers, packs his bag, gets his stuff that he needs that's essential, doesn't forget his wallet, heads out the door after giving assignments to the servants. And then on his way out, he looks at the doorkeeper. Now, the doorkeeper, that's an important role. He's the guy that permits entering and exiting the house. He's got to hold the door open and he's got to be aware of all who are going in. It's an important job. And on the way out, the man looks at the doorkeeper and he says, stay awake. You've got an important job on you, son. You got to stay awake. And in verse 34, he says, what I'm talking about, it's like that man going on a journey, leaving home, putting servants in charge, each with work, commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. The master of the house will return. That's why the wakefulness is appropriate for the servants and the doorkeeper. Now, why is Jesus making that comparison? Because he is the master of the house in the parable. And the disciples are the doorkeeper servant characters who have tasks and responsibilities that they are to be faithful to, for the master will come again. They don't know the day. They don't know the hour. They must simply live in a wakeful manner that will not cause the master to be dishonored. In verse 35, he applies the parable to them. If they haven't gotten it already, he's saying to them, therefore, stay awake. And the reason is unpacked again. You don't know when the master of the house will come. So the parable is for the disciples. Friends, the parable is for Cosmosdale Baptist Church. The parable is for the saints of God, that we, not knowing the hour and day of the return of Christ, would live lives wakeful and watchful before him. For the master of the house will come. He gives different night watches here, because if people were sleeping, it would typically be at night. OK, so if in verse 35 we see these four phrases, know that these are typical Roman night watch divisions. He says he might come in the evening. He might come at midnight when the rooster crows or in the morning. So there might be people who are going to bed early so that if he came late evening, they'd already be asleep. Maybe certainly by midnight, certainly at the rooster crowing at an early hour in the morning, and certainly when the sun comes up in the morning. He's saying here that the master of the house is going to come, and there are times when people would naturally be asleep and caught off guard. In fact, we know that sinister things happen at night all the time because people's guard is down, or they're in bed. They can't see. They're totally unaware. They're dead to the world. They're out cold. And then all of a sudden something may startle them awake. And it's very frightening when that happens, if you are alarmed that something could be going wrong. The reason it's alarming is because the person who is startled awake is not ready for it. Jesus doesn't want us to live in an unready manner. Instead, when we are asleep in the way Jesus is warning us not to be, we are conducting and living in a posture or in a manner that is displeasing to the Lord. These are four divisions familiar to the people of Jesus' day because of the way Rome would divide its watches of the night. There are other reasons, though, this division is important. Think about these phrases for a second. Evening, midnight, rooster crows, and in the morning. Not only are these Roman night watch divisions, these are like an interesting template or pattern for the upcoming episodes, if you'll follow me this way. On Thursday of Passion Week, we might bring up that first night watch, the evening episode. On Thursday of Passion Week, Jesus is going to be eating the Last Supper with his disciples. What about the midnight reference, which is given next? Well, that Thursday night around midnight is when he's going to be arrested by the temple soldiers and Jewish leaders. What about when the rooster crows early Friday morning before the sun comes up? That's when Peter will be denying Jesus. And what about that morning, which would be later that Friday morning, is when Jesus is crucified, beginning around 9 a.m. Here's what I think the disciples don't realize is coming. They're going to see firsthand that they are not nearly as wakeful as they should be. They're about to live through a series of events on an evening and midnight and rooster crowing and a morning that are truly distressing. Back to that evening episode, later in Mark 14, we are going to see that at that evening meal, Jesus will say, "One of you will betray me, and it would have been better for that man if he had not been born." It's quite a series of words to process there on that evening. What about the midnight episode? We know in Mark 14 that approximately at that time in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is going to be arrested by the leaders and temple officers. The rooster is going to crow with Peter denying Jesus not once, not twice, but three times, saying, "I do not know him. I swear I don't know him." And then in that following morning, that Friday morning, as Thursday passes into Friday, Jesus will be crucified by the Romans at the urging and pleading of the Jews. What about the disciples in all of this? Well, Judas would have betrayed him. The disciples will have scattered, and Peter will have denied Jesus. This is not a group living a wakeful life. This is a group not ready, not prepared. Forget the final day of judgment. They're not ready for what's coming Thursday and Friday. Jesus is going to tell them things that they're going to show that very week they have no strength of their own and resources on their own that are going to get them through this. He tells them to stay awake. In verse 36, "Lest he, the master of the house, comes suddenly and find you asleep." That's the situation that's undesirable. That the return of Christ would result in the slumbering spiritually of his disciples. If the servants are found asleep when they're supposed to be watchful, they are forsaking their duties and dishonoring the master of the house. In applying the parable, Jesus wants to find his disciples faithful, and that broadly applies across the centuries to our day. Our seeking first the kingdom is the way to be found faithful before Christ at his return. Because he says in verse 37, "What I say to you, I say to all." Stay awake, he says. That final word in verse 37, "stay awake," extends to everyone. Mark's readers who first received the gospel, and we who are reading it today. Our greatest need for 2019 is spiritual wakefulness. That was no less true in 2018. That year, though, is come and gone. Our greatest need in 2019 is to have a wakeful life. Because there are things we do not know. And there is a Christ who calls us. What do we find in addition to this call? We find that we are weak. We hear the call, and yet if we know ourselves, we think, "How, though, Lord? And for how long?" The things of this world have a very lulling capacity, don't they? A spiritual weariness can set in. We know this to be true. We are not strangers to the reality that we are trying to follow Christ in a fallen world where we do not have it all together. And life is hard and surrounded by things that bring weariness and temptation, not just externally, but internally what we face. We can see the words of the psalmist true from time to time in our own lives in Psalm 42 and 43. Why are you downcast, O my soul? The disciples will learn in short order that they do not have what it takes in their own strength and resources to be wakeful. They're actually going to face tests about literally staying awake. Do you remember the episode where in Mark 14, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's got Peter, James, and John in a closer proximity to him than the other disciples. And he says to them, in Mark 14, I'm going to go and pray. Remain here and watch. Now, the reader of Mark's gospel knows that Jesus has earlier taught his disciples about being awake and watchful. Now, let's see how they do. He says, stay here and pray. I'm going to go off. So the master of the house departs, if you will. And he comes back. And in Mark 14, 37, he came and found them sleeping. He said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? You ever ask somebody that when they're sleeping? Simon, are you asleep? And so what? You know they're sleeping. But they might need to wake up. He says, could you not watch for 1 hour? 1 hour. Jesus says, watch and pray that you might not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Now we know that line. That line is familiar to us, and not just because we've read it before. We know by experience in life, the spirit is willing and the flesh is weak. And Jesus is not aloof. He's not someone who doesn't understand our human condition. He's not someone who sees what we are going through and has no help or sympathies from the throne of grace. We bring our needs to him, and Jesus doesn't wring his hands thinking, how can I help these people who need this? Jesus knows that the call to wakefulness must be followed by the empowerment of the Son of God for his disciples, for their flesh is weak and on display. Could you not watch 1 hour, he says. Well, then he left them to pray again. Now, if you're Peter, James, and John, you might be thinking, well, I'm going to at least stand up. I don't know if they were sitting down or laying down, but I'm going to at least stand up for this second go around because there the master has gone again. And Jesus, you know how it goes. He comes back, and in chapter 14:40, he found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy and they didn't know what to answer him at that point. He leaves and comes back a third time. Same people, same spot, same Jesus, all in a row. And he comes back and he finds them. He says, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Mark 14, 40 and 41. It seems significant that in Mark 13, in our passage today, he's told them three times to keep or to stay awake. And they will fail three times in the very next chapter. There's a nice symmetry for how this goes, knowing that these disciples have a spirit that's willing, and yet the weakness of the flesh is real. Yet, what does it mean to stay awake that the disciples should consider? Praying that they might not fall into temptation. Earlier I said it's not primarily about physical rest. And it's not. Because the problem was more than just the disciples being tempted to sleep because they were tired. And nearing this late hour in the night, it's understandable that someone would feel the weariness of their eyes. Jesus is much more concerned about the state of their heart. And that is the most important thing about us. to consider that in the state of our heart before God, we have a weakness that Christ is addressing by his powerful sovereign word, calling us to watchfulness and wakefulness. The wakeful life is one in which we seek what we ought to be seeking and flee what we ought to be fleeing. One question we have to ask ourselves this morning is, what am I seeking in life right now? What am I looking for? What am I prioritizing? The way I'm spending my day, my week, my months, what is it that someone would look at from the outside and say, this is what this person is seeking? If you are not seeking the Lord Christ above all things, he calls you this morning to wake up. Because you have been lulled into a weariness and a dreariness spiritually, where you might be numbed by the things of this world or the weakness of your own flesh and the realness of sin and Satan. And he calls you this morning, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It's time to wake up. He calls you to wakefulness. The reason has to do with who we are in Christ. Listen to Paul's language about this very notion of being awake versus being asleep. In 1 Thessalonians 5, right after the prediction about the return of Christ at the end of chapter 4, in chapter 5 he says, concerning times and seasons, you have no need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves are aware the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying, peace and security, sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But you brothers, he says, you brothers are not in the dark. He says in verse 5, we are children of the light, children of the day. So now we understand why the posture of wakefulness is important. He's not talking about not sleeping at night. He's talking about the way we live. Are we of the darkness or are we of the light? He says you're of the day, children of the light and of the day. So he says in verse 6, let us not then sleep as others do, but keep awake. In verse 8, since we belong to the day, let us be sober-minded, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. Christ, in verse 10, died for us, so that whether we wake or sleep, we might live for him. He says, then encourage one another with these words. So just as the return of Christ is to be a measure of encouragement, the manner of Christian living is also to be part of the exhortation that we're called to wakefulness, and that that's an encouraging thing because the return of Christ will come and evil will be vanquished and the people of God will be raised unto life everlasting. This is not something to be lulled to sleep in, but rather the things that beset sinners in this world lull and drag and numb our sensitivities to the things of Christ. So a wakeful life is to be seeking what you ought to be seeking and fleeing what you ought to be fleeing. Otherwise, you are asleep and not awake. So hear the words of Christ today. A wakeful life is a Christ-exalting life. A wakeful life is a sin-hating and wisdom-seeking life. A wakeful life is a Bible-reading and church-devoted life. A wakeful life is a song-singing and prayer-speaking life. It is a burden-sharing and neighbor-loving life. That is the life Christ has called us to. This is the wakeful, watchful result of the Son of God's words coming to this fallen world in our condition saying, awake. The wakeful life is a fruit-bearing and peacemaking and cross-centered life. You see, the servants and the doorkeeper in the parable in verse 34 of Mark 13 are doing what they're doing because their thoughts are about the master of the house. And there is a saturation with, an awareness of Christ that is to pervade our lives in his word and in our gatherings and in our prayer and in our speech, so that as the doorkeepers and servants of the master's house, if you will, he will come find us faithful because apart from him, we were concerned for his duties, the tasks and responsibilities and commission of making disciples of all nations. A wakeful life is a disciple-making life. Because the doorkeepers and the servants of the house are busying themselves and prioritizing the master of the house, for they know he will come. And they want to be found faithful, for they know that when he comes, he will raise us from the dead. He will vanquish what is evil, and he will make all things new. Jesus says, stay awake.